Oh, it's such an honor, Danny, to be a part of this amazing podcast you're doing here. And it's just really cool to be talking about this book.
You know my work and you've given it a lot of thought, and I don't normally get such good questions, to be honest.
That was so fun.
Yeah, it sure was, especially the quiz. Thanks for preparing that for me.
Thank you for your wonderful questions.
Best with these things, just turn into a conversation.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. Yeah, you obviously got the book.
Good on you for fighting the good fight too.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you guys.
I love your enthusiasm. I just think it's a brilliant thing you're doing, a podcast about, you know, books, and you do a lot of great interviews, so I'm really honoured to be part of it.
I so enjoy listening to the podcast. I truly, I love it.
You're listening to Words and Nerds Podcast with Danny V.
Today I welcome DM Cameron to talk about her beautiful novel, Beneath the Mother Tree. A spine-chilling mystery and contemporary love story, Beneath the Mother Tree plays out in a unique and wild Australian setting, interweaving Indigenous history and Irish mythology.
Welcome, DM Cameron. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. I'm really excited to speak to you about Beneath the Mother Tree.
Thank you, Danny. Thank you very much. I'm excited to be here.
And one of the descriptions of the novel is a spine-chilling mystery and contemporary love story played out in a unique and wild Australian setting, interweaving Indigenous history and Irish mythology. Now, this is one of the descriptions I found in the novel, and it just brings up so many questions for me. First of all, and this is often a very hard question because ideas emerge from everywhere, but how did this idea emerge for you?
I think it emerged from a question, in a way, that I had been asking myself most of my life without even realising it. Just that whole idea of how do I connect to this landscape as a fourth and fifth generation, mainly Irish descent, where my ancestors are actually from a country on the other side of the world. And I think that question arose for me because where I spent a lot of my formative years in the Quandamooka area, where the novel is set, there is a big Indigenous population. So there was a mission there for over 50 years, so there's still a strong Indigenous population. I went to school with Indigenous kids, so I was always aware that there was their direct connection to country. And I think it was when I had children, I started to really question it, because I was teaching my kids to look for fairies in the landscape, and but I was also teaching them things I picked up along the way, like local folklore, you know. And then I thought, well, it's quite a mongrel mythology I've got happening here. And is this, you know, is this the right way to connect to the landscape? I suppose that was the trigger, but I didn't set out to go, oh, you know, I'm going to be didactic. And it's interesting deconstructing what you have written after you've written it,
because didn't even know that was inside of you.
Yeah, and the mythology that you create around your book after it's released, and you have to do so many interviews and all of that as well, like I've realized lately it might sound like I you know, had this grand plan, but I didn't really. It just kind of came to me, and I didn't really know what I was writing at all.
And being an English teacher yourself, it's just natural to just analyse everything, isn't it?
Yeah.
You were saying before that connection, and I find that really interesting, because talking about, you know, your ancestry in Ireland and then trying to have that connection with the land and Indigenous people, and I see what's going on in the news, especially when Australia Day comes up, and I feel like you're right, that connection between people from different ancestry, from, you know, from different places, it's just not there hundreds of years later, is it? And we're still not connecting in a way that is meaningful.
Well, I think because of colonization, there's big scarring that's occurred. It's like an open wound still, really. Difficult history we have. So, yeah, that that really influenced the book in lots of ways too, the whole history.
Yeah, and it's so important, you know, to try and connect those two together, because ultimately that's what makes up Australia. How we do that, I don't know, you know, but obviously there's a lot of talk about it at the moment.
And also, even like blood-wise, so my partner, he has Indigenous blood on his mother's side, which is quite a few generations back. So my children have Indigenous blood, but, you know... We are kind of coming together even physically as a nation.
Yeah, absolutely. I hope I hope it improves and we manage to move forward with all of this, you know, this sort of anger that comes, especially around January. And, you know, you think Australia should be coming together as a nation of one people who really empathise with each other. And
They need to change the date.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It's so simple. It's simple. Like a no-brainer.
I know. Just change the date, you know. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know how hard that is. Just do it.
So it's frustrating. How beautiful would it be if the date is changed and everyone can celebrate?
Yeah, absolutely. Because at the moment it's very divisive and it's terrible.
Well, I was down at our local beach and there was not one Australian flag this year. It was very interesting.
Yeah.
So interesting. I thought, well, it's got to happen. It will happen.
Absolutely, it will. But things just... happen a lot slower than I would like them to happen, I think.
Yeah.
Now, talking about setting, obviously extremely important part of the book, and I love the Australian wilderness, because whenever I read a book set in Australia, it does have that sense of danger and unpredictability and wildness. How did you create the setting to then reflect the ideas in the novel?
Well, the setting's real, so... It played a big part in my formative years, that whole area. So I didn't really have to create that, I suppose. But I think what you're asking is how's that reflected?
In what you were trying to say, yeah.
Yeah, I suppose the mosquitoes, biggest killers of humans in the world, and the mangrove swamp. So the island that the book is set on has a huge mangrove swamp attached to it, and you know, the lethal mud and the tripwire roots, you wouldn't want to end up there in the middle of the night being attacked by mosquitoes. So I suppose that, and the tea tree swamps, they're impenetrable. And the death that occurs, I think one of the opening images, or an image that's mentioned early, is a dead dugong on the beach, which has propeller marks through it, you know. And that was really, I remember when I was living on one of the islands, coming across a dead dugong with propeller marks on it, and it's this beautiful big beast, all cut up.
Wow. It's a really powerful image, isn't it?
Yeah, well, made it into the book.
They do that, don't they, these powerful images? They stay with you.
And the mutton birds. I don't know if you've ever been on a beach that has dead mutton birds, but that's so gothic. Yeah, I suppose there's a lot of death in the landscape.
Yeah, and I just love that danger and wildness and unpredictability, and I find that Australia is such a wonderful setting to create those kind of things.
Mm-hmm. And one of the characters in the novel definitely embodies that. We can't give too much.
No, that's why, you know, sometimes these conversations are difficult because you want to get into an area, but you don't want to obviously spoil anything. I find it almost impossible with psychological thrillers. I sometimes sit there and go, so we can't talk about that or this or that because of all the reveals. So shall we talk about? Now, talking about before, what I really loved was the interweaving of the Indigenous history and the Irish mythology. How difficult was it to bring the two together to tell one story?
Well, the Irish mythology was easy. That, you know, that seemed to burst out of me. I grew up looking for fairies in the bush, so you know, that was a part of me. The Indigenous side was a bit more difficult. I actually worked with an Indigenous elder, Uncle Bob Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I suppose I had fantasies that I'd be looking at Indigenous mythology and combining it, sort of trying to find the common points with the Irish mythology. But what happened was I discovered the true history of the area that I'd known most of my life, and it shocked the hell out of me. And I realised that their connection to country is actually overlaid with the very recent awful violence,
mm-hmm.
tragedy. And so they see the landscape, well, I can now see that landscape in that way too. Go to a beautiful headland, it may not just be a beautiful headland, it may be where, you know, their great-great, or their great, or even their grandmother
mm-hmm.
was murdered. So.
And hopefully readers can begin to understand that as well, and that's where we can start to connect, can't we, with that sort of empathy for others.
Yeah, well, the history's not talked about.
Mm.
I had no idea. I was in my 40s when I found all of this out, and I was so, yeah, gutted by that.
Mm.
There's no documents, there's no records, it's just the local mob knows yeah. the stories. So.
And that's why it's so important to tell stories like these, isn't it? So people begin to understand and begin to hear these stories.
Yeah, I think it's vital. Yeah, and then influenced the book big time and made it much darker. And, you know, there's definitely gothic element to the mm-hmm. book now that I didn't set out to.
Love the way you said that you worked with an elder, Uncle Bob Anderson, because I think when you're doing your research, you kind of have a responsibility to tell the stories in a way that is empathetic and reflective of their experience. Tell me about working with him. It must have been a real eye-opener.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, as a white writer, there was no question. I wasn't even going to go anywhere near Indigenous characters or content without, you know, having someone guide me. But the one thing I can say is I didn't ever write from an Indigenous perspective. They're only ever seen, the characters are only ever seen through the white character's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it was very interesting working with Uncle Bob because I, as a playwright, had worked with dramaturgs for years, you know, usually white males who would, you turn up and they'd have red marks all through your manuscript and pages of notes for you to take down. And so I stupidly assumed it would be a similar process. I sent Uncle Bob the manuscript and we arranged to meet in a couple of months, and when we met, you know, we sat down, we had a cup of tea, and the manuscript was on the table, like a big white elephant in the room, and it was huge then. It was like 120,000 words, so it was a first draft, and, you know, it's down to 80,000 now, but, yeah, he told me a story from his childhood, and we had a cup of tea, and his wife was there, it was all very lovely, and I kept trying to bring the conversation back to the manuscript, and he'd just kind of look at it and then tell me another beautiful story, you know, his aunt or something. And this went on for, and I just thought, oh, he hasn't read it obviously, so we arranged to meet again, and this went on for months. And in the end I was getting really frustrated. I thought, oh, is this some kind of test, or, you know, a test of patience, or... And he kept saying things like, oh, you know, I come from an oral tradition. And, you know, it was actually me learning to listen.
Mm-hmm.
And I slowly, it dawned on me, I said, oh, I actually have to tell him my story. He's never going to read my manuscript. He comes from an oral tradition. He's not going to read that big manuscript. I need to. So I just said, next time I went to see him, I said, I'll tell you what, Uncle Bob, I'm just going to yarn you my story. I'm going to tell you in my own words exactly what happens. And he wasn't very well that day, so his wife, she said, oh, maybe we should just make it a short session. So I started telling him the story, and I said to him, look, when I get to the Indigenous sections, I'll read them out from the manuscript. And he said, yeah, that's fine. And anyhow, he got so enthralled with it all. And, you know, a couple of hours later, Kathy came out and she said, oh, you know, how are you feeling? He's like, no, we can't stop. We can't. No, I want to know what happens. And it was brilliant because he was waiting for me to tell him a story.
That's wonderful. It's wonderful on both levels, you know, the way he loved it and wanted to keep hearing it. And, you know, they're traditions of oral storytelling. And even now, like, stories are so much better when they're told, aren't they?
So he kept telling me stories in the hope that I was going to tell him my story. And I was just sitting there like a numbnut going, oh,
and he's like,
when are you going to...
He's like, is this a test of patience? What is she doing here?
And Kathy's wife at one point, I remember she had this real wry smile, and she's like, oh, because we were talking about circles, and I was asking him if there were circles that occurred, you know, in Indigenous traditions and ceremonies and stuff, and what they meant, because, like, in the Irish tradition, they're quite powerful, and there's a circle around the Irish cross for a reason. And and at one point Kathy just said, yeah, so it's almost like talking in circles, like she could see what was happening between us. She was just sitting there watching, and, yeah, anyhow, eventually I realized, oh, he wants me to tell.
And how wonderful must that experience have been for you to be able to tell your story with someone listening to it? I think that would be wonderful.
Oh, it was so powerful, especially when, you know, I read out loud to him my massacre scene that I'd written about his country, where his grandmother had witnessed her family get killed. That was... I was sobbing. I was a weeping, absolute mess. And he just sat there and let me, you know, come to terms with everything. So that was really interesting. Just having him witness those words made me, it affected me in the fabric of my being.
Yeah, how powerful is that? I love that. I love the story of the power of storytelling, because it's so real, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a very special gift, getting to know Uncle Bob, and, yeah, he's a very special man, so...
Now, Beneath the Mother Tree was listed as one of the top Australian fiction reads for 2018 by the South Australian Weekend magazine. How does something like this feel when you've written this book, you've had this wonderful experience with an elder, and then you see that people are really appreciating your story?
That was bloody unreal. That was just, yeah, the highlight of the year. You know, it happened at the end of the year, so my book's been out it's almost 6 months now. So, yeah, published in August, and then, yeah, that happened in December. And, yeah, it was really right beside Tim Winton's The Shepherd's Hut. And Mr. Winton is one of my favourite Australian authors, so I was, like, absolutely gobsmacked. And
And the book community, they're just wonderful, like all of them, you know, authors, publishers, journalists, bloggers, podcasts, they just all come together because of that shared passion, because we know how important storytelling is. So it's just such a beautiful community. It's
isn't it? Yeah. I feel totally embraced.
And, very supportive. Yeah. You know, it's not really about, it's not very competitive with each other. It's just hear these great stories, let's share these great stories. And isn't that a wonderful community to be part of?
Absolutely. And, you know, I can understand that, because as a writer, you're sitting here on your own, at your desk, 24/7 half the time, not interacting with anyone. So you can go online, and then there's all these other poor suckers doing the same thing.
That's it.
So you can relate. You're like, yep.
Yep, I'm alone too. I'm sitting in my room alone as well.
Yep. Filled Hello, with self- how's it going?
Filled with self-doubt, looking at my walls. I hear that a lot.
Oh, it's brilliant. I love it.
Now, as a debut author, I mean, this book, it's beautiful and it's magical. Was this the first manuscript you had written, or had you written a few before but never gotten to the publishing stage?
Yeah, that was my first. The first thing I ever got published, actually, was a short story and some poetry but I've written most of my life, like mm-hmm. a diary, and I ended up writing plays for years and radio dramas. But this was actually my first novel, and it came to me as a novel. But the funny thing is, I often heard in prose when I was writing scripts,
and
I would have to translate that into dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think that's why my work did so well on radio, because I could move from like interior monologue into dialogue, because they would just change like the recording technique. And that's kind of what a novel is in a way. You're going, you know, from inside the character's head to dialogue, etc. So, I felt liberated writing Beneath the Mother Tree. I felt like finally my voice was free. It was a really, really, I just want to write novels now.
Because like you were saying, when you were writing plays, that involves a lot of other people, so actors and directors and people writing all these notes on your script.
Yes,
but the novel, obviously you work with an editor and publisher, but a lot of that time is just you writing, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's really immersive, and it also comes out of setting, which, you know, the landscape, you can't really do that in script mm-hmm. writing, whereas I so enjoyed writing the landscape in Beneath the Mother Tree. And all the senses, so it's so immersive. You're working with smell and touch and all of them.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just the best, but it is really hard. It's lots and lots and lots of work. But I don't want to go back to script writing. I really just want to write novels now, so.
Now, you were talking briefly, I mean, we haven't really touched on writing process yet, but we talked about the editing process of 120,000 words and that culling right back to 80,000, which is quite significant. So can you tell us about first your writing process for the novel and then how you managed to cut it back 40,000 words?
The first draft came quite quickly and was so much fun. I look back on that first draft. Now I'm working on another novel. Think, oh, if only I could get back that feeling of, yeah. But it was quite short, the first draft. And then I was lucky enough to get funding to work with Nicola O'Shea, this amazing structural editor. And she took it and pulled it apart like a jigsaw puzzle and put it all back together. Amazing what she did, and she had like notes, you need to write more in this section, so she helped me delve deeper into characters, etc. as well. Remarkable. I learned so much from her. I felt like I swallowed a mountain of knowledge. And I'm still digesting it. It became too big. Then it took me a while to learn how to bring it back to the 80,000 that it had to be at. So I was learning to write a book as I was writing a book, really.
But it's kind of beautiful, I think, the editing process, you know, something that's kind of loose and has, you know, quite a lot of shape to it. You're really paring it back to be that beautiful thing that goes out into the world. So you're working on a second and a third novel. Can you tell us anything about those?
Well, the second novel I wrote while I was waiting for the first one to get published, so I've actually put that one aside because I'm not really happy with it, and I will go back to it at some point. But yeah, so this one I'm working on at the moment, who knows which one will be published first. The one I'm working on at the moment is really exciting me. It's actually about a money man, a bonds trader who has a satori and ends up transferring a huge amount of money illegally and then has to go on the run and ends up living in a national park in a cave, like hiding out from the cops. But unbeknownst to him, there's an eco-warrior woman hiding already in that cave. And they end up going on a road trip and all sorts of things happen. But it's exciting.
Sounds wonderful and so different from the first novel.
Yeah, it is. They're all quite different, I've got to say. unpredictable.
But isn't that wonderful? I love that, how, you know, one person and one brain can just have so many different ideas or see the world in all these different ways and bring them together in a story. I love that when I see something different from authors. You know, they write something and you think you know what they're going to write next and they just hit you with a surprise. I like that.
Yeah, well, hopefully.
Thank you so much for chatting with me. And like we said, the book is such a unique book in its in the ideas, but such an important book as well, in that it brings together those, you know, Indigenous and Irish stories. And I think that's so important, especially for us now, and so relevant. And, you know, the power of storytelling is so important. So I think this is one of those books that hopefully will resonate with people. And like we talked about, all the sensory imagery throughout. And, you know, you don't get much better than that beautiful Australian wildness that makes people visit us, or people too scared to visit us.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me, Danny. It's been an absolute pleasure.